to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Postmodernism, in its sort of rejection of truth overall, has left this one area of truth remaining, and that's the lens of power.
So somewhere in between that time where I had that strong reaction to a Sanctity of Life Sunday and being offered an abortion, God changed my heart completely, and it was receiving God's word, properly distinguished law and gospel, that changed my heart.
Scientism takes the tool of science and it leverages it to justify a grand narrative of the universe, specifically without God or without reference to things divine.
Baptism is a work of Jesus to cleanse, to sanctify, to forgive His holy Christian church.
Hi, this is Jeff from Lithia, Florida. Beloved on-demand treadmill runners, love issues, etc.
Well, it has been a year with COVID-19, the pandemic. Now we're in the vaccine phase and questions remain. The information is often confusing. Sometimes it even appears to be contradictory, especially if you compare what you were hearing, say, 6 months ago with what you're hearing today, and we're still not out of the woods. But is there, to employ another metaphor, light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the pandemic? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, March the 12th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about COVID-19, the pandemic, and COVID vaccines, getting an update with Dr. Nicholas Wolgemuth of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. We'll go through listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line, answering your questions. And then Dr. Michael New will join us to review the new movie Roe v. Wade, and we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. We got four soundbites for you this week as usual. One on a story of going from pro-choice to pro-life. Another, what is scientism and is it science? Another, how we begin talking about baptism. And finally, soundbite number four, how students reconcile their militancy with their belief that truth is relative. We'll play those four sound bites for you in the last half hour of the program, and then you will vote and pick one of them to be soundbite of the week. You can vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Send us a tweet with your vote at issuesetc, or an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or wait and vote by giving us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE. Joining us to talk about COVID-19, the pandemic, and COVID vaccines, a little bit of an update, Dr. Nicholas Wolgemuth. He's postdoctoral research associate infectious diseases at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Dr. Wolgemuth, welcome back.
Howdy, it's good to be back.
What have we learned over the last year or so about coronavirus that we didn't know the last time we talked?
We've learned a great deal. Last time we talked, it was just basically using information from previous coronaviruses, other coronaviruses, and extrapolating that to the novel coronavirus. But now we really have a lot of experimental data to support a lot of the different measures and features that have been implemented since then. And so we really do know a lot more about the virus biology, how it spreads, and how it causes disease.
Are you surprised? I think some expressed doubt that a virus vaccine with a coronavirus could even be developed. Are you surprised that we have developed vaccines for it?
No. A lot of the other coronaviruses do have give immunity, at least for intermediate terms. And we know that based off of the original SARS epidemic, and we know that based off of some of the seasonal coronaviruses. The reason we don't have a SARS vaccine or a seasonal coronavirus vaccine, in the case of seasonal coronaviruses, they don't cause that severe of disease, so that's never really been pursued. Whereas with the original SARS, there were actually quite a few vaccines in development, but once the virus died out, it's no longer detected. So there was no point in pursuing vaccines against that. That being said, a couple of the vaccine candidates that are currently being tested are actually vaccines that were originally developed against the MERS coronavirus, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus. And those vaccine platforms and the research on those for the related virus have really helped spring forward some of the development of the vaccines that we're currently seeing people that are already getting put into people's arms.
One more question before we get to our listeners' questions. It has been a year since the pandemic was declared. Did you expect it to last this long?
I was hopeful that once the vaccine came out, we would be able to get everything back to normal or as close to normal as the world is going to look after all this. And I think a year, you know, I'm actually surprised that we were able to get everything done. And they did a great job designing the clinical trials for the vaccines to show that they are safe and efficacious as in record time. And so if anything, I'm surprised that, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel is closer than I expected.
Here are some questions that our listeners have sent us regarding both the virus, the pandemic, and the vaccines, beginning with Logan in Arlington, Minnesota. Logan says, I have heard that people that have been vaccinated should still follow social distancing and face mask wearing guidelines. I'm a bit confused by this. Is there a reason why that is the case?
This is an excellent question and one that we just recently got an answer to. The CDC just updated their guidance and says that fully vaccinated individuals can interact with other fully vaccinated individuals indoors without socially distancing. However, while we know that the vaccine is good and we expect it to be good at blocking the transmission of the virus, and the early evidence suggests that that is the case, that doesn't mean that just because you got the vaccine, you won't be able to catch it later and then potentially spread it. And so the recommendations are still in place for even if you've been fully vaccinated, when you're interacting with people that aren't fully vaccinated, you should still wear a mask and try to socially distance. That being said, everything's just going to be a little bit safer once you're vaccinated. And once a vast majority of the adult population is vaccinated, I think we'll be able to loosen up on a lot of those guidelines.
Karen asks, do any of the vaccines offer immunity or simply a reduction of symptoms? Why do we hear zero about strengthening our immune systems?
Well, that's actually how all of these vaccines work. Sometimes with like the case of influenza virus, when the vaccine strain isn't matched well, you will see a predominant, you know, you might still get the flu, but you won't get it as bad. You'll just have a reduction in symptoms. But the goal of this vaccine is to do exactly that, provide what's known as sterilizing immunity so that you never even get infected with the virus, that the virus can't even get in you at all. Most vaccines work that way. That being said, if we do see some of the variants emerge, it might be that it's more of a symptom-reducing vaccine. But right now, the vaccine is working against all of the predominantly circulating variants. And so we are actually getting a good immune response to the vaccine that's protecting lots and lots of people that have already been vaccinated.
Dave in Troy, Michigan tweets, can the doctor shed light on super spreader events and also the role of good air ventilation preventing the spread of the virus?
Yeah, super spreader phenomena are actually they're not exactly unique to coronaviruses, but they're maybe best well understood in coronaviruses. And that's because the original SARS virus, you know, it died out relatively quickly because it didn't actually transmit that well between people, but it did spread for a while. And that's because you had what are known as super spreaders. You would have one person getting sick, flying on an airplane, and then dozens of people on that airplane would end up getting sick. You had an instance of someone in a hotel and basically everyone who stayed on the floor with that person got sick with SARS. And so the novel coronavirus ends up being similar. Most people who get sick probably don't spread the virus to anyone, or if they do, you know, it's probably just the people in their household. But there's some fraction of people that, because of some unique aspect of their biology, when they become infected, they just get really infectious, which means they're able to spread the virus very well. We don't know what makes someone a super spreader, but this is a very active area of research that a lot of groups are working on, because as you might imagine, if we can identify super spreaders, we can target therapies and preventative measures even better.
What about Dave's thought about good air ventilation?
Yeah, air ventilation is really important. We've known for years that HEPA filters and proper air ventilation can reduce the spread of infectious diseases, especially viruses, by constantly pulling the air through that filter. You're filtering out the viruses. So you can drastically decrease the risk of infection indoors. And like on an airplane, that air conditioned vent you have is actually, that's getting recycled through the air's HEPA filter. So that's actually some of the cleanest air on the airplane is the air that's coming out of there. And so a lot of schools especially are looking into some engineering to try to improve their air ventilation. And I think all of that is going to help.
Daniel says, is this really a vaccine as defined by the CDC, or is it really more like the annual flu shot? Also, does the mRNA shot permanently alter the genes of the human recipient?
So vaccines are very simply defined as substances used to stimulate a protective immune response. And that's usually thought of as an antibody response. And both the flu shot, actually, and the mRNA and all of the different coronavirus vaccines do just that. They work by inducing an immune response. And as for the second part of the question, no, the mRNA vaccine does not alter the genes of the human recipient. There's no evidence that this occurs when it's been tested in tissue culture, when it's been tested in animals, and when what we've seen in humans. There's been just, this does not happen. And so that's not something to be concerned about with these vaccines.
Sue asks, does any other vaccine that has been proven, like for mumps or polio, use the mRNA? And do any of the COVID vaccines use fetal cells from aborted babies? What might be some of the side effects of using the mRNA? Do any of the COVID vaccines provide true immunity?
So yeah, I'll take the questions, I'll answer the questions one at a time. So this is the first mRNA vaccine to be used in humans. However, the mRNA platform has actually been in development for a really long time. People have been trying to optimize it because they understood the power of being able to make these vaccines. Now that we have the mRNA vaccine pipeline ready, it could be that, you know, if a novel virus emerged tomorrow, we could have shots ready for testing in days. And so the mRNA platform, while this is the first one, every new therapeutic, every new drug or vaccine is started off somewhere else and was the first of its type. And so that being said, the mRNA vaccines have actually been looked at for a variety of livestock and animal diseases where they've worked well. And so, you know, between the evidence in the basic science studies and in the clinical trials, there's, I don't think, much fear to being able to use this, be the first mRNA vaccine available. And then on to the second question. And that was, do any of the COVID vaccines use fetal cells from aborted babies? And importantly here, the mRNA vaccines did not use any fetal tissue in their development or production. And so the mRNA vaccines, there's no risk if you're concerned about that. There's absolutely nothing to worry about with the mRNA vaccines. However, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and some of the vectored vaccines did actually use cells descended from fetal tissue, but not the fetal tissue itself. So in a case like this, I would suggest that you get whatever vaccine is offered to you. But if you are concerned about this, then you can go ahead and ask your doctor or pharmacist if you can get one of the mRNA vaccines. You might have to wait a little bit longer, but if that's a risk you're willing to accept for getting a vaccine you're more ethically comfortable with, that's just a decision you have to make on your own.
What about side effects of the mRNA vaccine?
As far as we know, and through all of the testing and monitoring, there are no side effects specifically associated with the mRNA vaccine, although you do get some of the common vaccination side effects like injection site soreness and kind of feeling crummy for a day or two after. And those seem to be a little bit worse in the mRNA vaccine. And I take that to mean that the vaccine is working really well. It's your immune response that's making you feel sick, that's making your arm feel sore. And so if you're feeling a little extra crummy after your vaccine, it's because you're mounting, most likely because you're mounting a really good immune response to it.
What do we know about the degree of immunity provided by these vaccines, according to Sue's question?
So yeah, it varies by vaccine. We know that the mRNA vaccines are very efficacious. They basically, no one in the trials died and no one had severe disease and very few people got infected. For the Johnson & Johnson, a few more people, you know, it was a little bit less efficacious in total number of infections prevented, but it did a great job at preventing both severe disease and death.
Dr. Nicholas Wolgemuth is our guest from St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. We're getting an update on COVID-19, the pandemic, and COVID vaccines. On the other side of the break, Samantha asks about reported cases of miscarriage and stillbirths occurring after vaccination. How should Lutherans respond to the assertion, "Your church is too Catholic"? Find out in Pastor Will Whedon's column in the latest Issues Etc. Journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Joshua Pauling traces his path from big box evangelicalism and Reformed Calvinism to the treasures of historic Christianity found in the Lutheran Church, the free online Issues Etc. Journal.
Can you ever hear too much good news? Especially in challenging times, we need to hear how God is working through His church to bring truth, goodness, and beauty to the world. Hi, this is Rahema Kavuga of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Take a break from cable news and find refreshment at interesttime.org, where you can read all about what's happening in places like St. Mark Lutheran Church and School in Kaneohe, Hawaii. Sign up for a free subscription and share with anyone that needs a good boost. Again, that's interesttime.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Join the Concordia University Chicago Wind Symphony and the Sheboygan Lutheran High School Symphonic Band as they celebrate the gospel through the gift of music. Tune into the live streaming concert, Coast to Coast, Praising Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, on Friday, March 12th at 7:30 p.m. You can also help the schools reach their goal of having congregations from all 50 states watching. Learn more about becoming a partner congregation and supporting Christian music at LutheranHigh.com.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about COVID-19, the pandemic, and COVID vaccines, getting an update with Dr. Nicholas Wolgemuth. He is postdoctoral research associate infectious diseases at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Superstition is the theme of the March issue of the Lutheran Witness magazine. It contains columns by Issues Etc. guests John Bombaro, Matt Harrison, Adam Francisco, and Gene Edward Veith. The Lutheran Witness is available in print and online. Find out more at lcms.org/witness or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, Interpreting the Contemporary World from a Lutheran Perspective, the Lutheran Witness magazine. Dr. Wolgemuth, Samantha in Florida asks this question. Please comment on reported cases of miscarriage and stillbirths occurring after COVID-19 vaccinations.
There's no known link between COVID-19 vaccinations and miscarriages or stillbirth. There's actually a federal program, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. It's run by the Department of Health and Human Services, and it tracks all adverse events that occur after vaccinations. That can be anything from getting in a car crash to just, you know, any sort of medical thing. And they do this as a precaution. It's not because they suspect that anything that bad that happens to you after you get vaccinated was caused by the vaccine. But if enough people that get a vaccine, for example, have car accidents the next day, then you might think that, well, maybe they have a delayed reaction time, and that could be a side effect of the vaccine. That's not something we've seen here, but they monitor everything in this, what's known as the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And they look at everyone and they check everything, and it's actually publicly available data. And so you can go ahead and look up at their website and see for yourself, you know, what sort of adverse events have been reported. And One thing that will get some lay people confused when they go to the website is they will see adverse events reported. And that, again, that's not because the vaccine caused it. It's just a way to monitor adverse events. And so in the case of miscarriages and stillbirths, they do occur after vaccination, but they do occur just unfortunately naturally anyway. And so it looks like they occur at about the same rates in both women who've gotten the vaccine and women who've not. And so it does not seem to, the vaccines, there's no evidence that they lead to miscarriages or stillbirths.
Christy asks, we've been told that COVID-19 is a much more deadly illness virus than any other we've experienced in the modern age. However, statistical data indicates that COVID deaths for 2020 are roughly the same as those who died from influenza during each of the last several years. Her first question, what factors determine that COVID is the cause of a high number of deaths, and can we believe these numbers?
The data that was given, it might just be a little bit out of date, but there, on average, there's about 10 to 50,000 influenza deaths every year. It can vary by a lot depending on a bunch of different factors. But there's actually been over, you know, 10 times that. There's been over 530,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the U.S. And so this virus is causing a lot more deaths than influenza. And while COVID-19 isn't particularly deadly compared to other viruses you might think of, like Ebola or the original SARS, it is still more deadly than the flu, especially in aged individuals. It can be as deadly as Ebola in those populations, whereas as flu is going to still be, you're going to be at a higher risk for severe disease or death if you're older, but nothing compared to the risk you have if you get COVID-19.
A question of my own, since you mentioned the morbidity for older populations, especially 65 and above. Do we know why COVID thankfully seems to have so little effect on children?
We don't know exactly. It's almost certainly got something to do with how children respond to viruses. Their immune systems are, or your immune system changes as you age. And it could simply be that little kids, their immune systems, you know, potentially, you know, before puberty, for example, are just excellent at stopping this. There's basically no severe cases in elementary aged children. That's not the case. We do know somewhat what makes older individuals more at risk, but it's still pretty early to say, but there are lots of labs working on that right now.
Kathy says, the rationale for wearing masks seems to be changing frequently. At first, the public was told masks were unnecessary. Now we seem to be hearing the other extreme. Pre-COVID science said masks were not essential. In fact, peer-reviewed science data from before 2020 not only said that masks don't stop viruses, but that in some cases can cause other health problems. Now we're being told something completely different. What can we believe, and how can it change so quickly? In the past, I felt I could trust the media and science when it came to medical matters. Now there is so much conflict in this. How do I know the truth?
Well, this is actually how science works. We start with information. We pull the best information we have, and then we give the answer to the best of our abilities. But as we learn more and we learn that we were wrong about certain things, as scientists and, you know, anyone should change their opinion when given new, better data. That being said, we actually have always, we've known for a long time, masks work best at preventing the spread of disease from a sick person to a healthy individual. That's, you know, one reason why doctors wear surgical masks when they perform surgeries, so that their germs they're breathing out don't get into the incision site and cause infection. So early on in the pandemic, when there were almost no cases in the US, there really wasn't a need to wear masks. And that's why, you know, I'll often see a quote from Anthony Fauci in March of last year saying that there's no reason to be wearing masks. And at the time, he was right. There was so few cases that almost no one was infected. And so if we use masks predominantly to prevent a sick person from spreading the virus, if you're not sick with COVID-19, then you don't need to wear a mask. But as we've learned more about the virus and we've learned more about asymptomatic individuals that can still shed the virus and are contagious, and as we've learned that there's a period of time after you get infected with the virus, but before you start showing symptoms where you're very infectious. And so that's why the masks are recommended and mandated in some areas now, because of the risk that, you know, you may not know you're infected, but you might still be breathing out lots of virus. And so that is kind of the rough outline of how the science has changed over time, how we've learned more about this situation, and that is what has caused things to change. That being said, you know, early on, we didn't know what masks were going to be effective. And so I know I was confused for a while about, you know, are the cloth masks okay? What about the net gaiters? And there's been some studies now, enough studies that have shown that cloth masks are effective at preventing transmission of the virus, as long as it's you know, potentially a multi-layered cloth and a high thread count.
Joyce in Iowa says, as a senior citizen, I had COVID. I lost my taste and smell for 2 weeks, which was my self-COVID test. I did not go in for a test. I gave blood and it came back that I had the antibodies. Why on earth would I ever get this shot if my immune system has the antibodies?
So if you have the antibodies, you are likely protected, at least for a little while. The CDC is recommending that people get vaccinated, even if they already had the virus. The worst case scenario is that you just boost your immune system so that you get an even better immune response. And so depending on your exact situation, I would just suggest you follow the CDC guidelines. But for most individuals, that means getting vaccinated, even if you had COVID-19.
Karen in Illinois has a question again about the death numbers. The death count, at least in some places, includes deaths which were due to other causes, but the person also tested positive for COVID-19. Will the true death toll from COVID-19 ever be told?
Well, this is something I've heard before, and I think some people are concerned about, you know, hospitals overreporting, because, you know, there's a potential that, you know, they might get more insurance money. But I think that would be, you know, we can kind of rule that out, because that would be very blatant insurance fraud. And I'm pretty sure the insurance companies would catch that pretty quick. So that is the fraud part of it doesn't seem likely. What I would say is happening is that when you have severe cases of COVID-19, which by nature, any fatal case is going to be severe, the virus can actually be replicating so much and causing damage to what are known as like your endothelial cells. And that can lead to organ damage. And so the virus can actually either escape the lungs, or the effects of the virus can escape the lungs and lead to damage in, you know, the heart, the lung, or the kidney through a process known as immunopathology. And it's possible that COVID-19 could even cause these organs to fail. So in that case, the cause of death might be liver failure, but that would be attributed to COVID-19. In most cases, the person would have lived if not for COVID-19. So therefore, it counts as a COVID-19 death. But in that case, you know, if you have someone who, for example, has liver disease, maybe they're a recovering alcoholic, so their liver is not fully functional, and they get COVID-19, that can, and they can get a severe case of it, that can push them into, you know, liver failure and death. And so that person would have lived if they hadn't gotten infected, but ultimately it was the liver failure that killed them. And so that's where the confusion can come from.
So these comorbidities that we hear so often about, they are intended to say, look, we understand additional risk factors that could lead to death, but that does not mean, well, they were going to die of that anyway, and COVID just helped them along.
Yeah, exactly.
Carrie writes, I've seen a lot of serious reactions at our hospital, ranging from heart palpitations, high blood pressure, blood clots, and stroke. I was wondering what your opinion on this is, and if the risks outweigh the consequences. Once we started using ivermectin, even our sickest patients bounced back within 48 hours. I haven't had a patient in over 2 months, and I haven't seen a positive test. Is herd immunity a better way to go?
Given the fact that 1 to 2,000 Americans are dying every day from COVID-19, I don't think that herd immunity is the way to go. While there are some mild side effects with the vaccine, there are no serious side effects yet that have been identified. So just because someone has a stroke after receiving the vaccine doesn't mean that the vaccine caused the stroke. It could just be a coincidence. And we actually know from the influenza virus vaccine that getting the flu shot actually decreases your risk of heart attack and stroke. And so I'm not a medical doctor, but I would actually imagine that getting the COVID vaccine has a good chance of protecting you a bit extra from the risk of heart attack and stroke. And so I imagine that in this case, the risk of the vaccine is very low and the benefit is very high. So I think that's the direction that is being pursued.
Dr. Nicholas Wogelmuth is our guest from St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. We're getting an update on COVID-19, the pandemic, and COVID vaccines. We'll talk a little bit about the approved for emergency use next. You can help new Christians or those curious about the true Easter miracle with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, A Simple Explanation of Easter. These booklets are sold in packets of 20, making them perfect for outreach programs, new member classes, and in-church pews. Find out more about A Simple Explanation of Easter at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, A Simple Explanation of Easter.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Hi, this is Pastor Brian Katchelmeyer of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Over the next 5 years, Los Alamos National Laboratory is planning to hire thousands of new employees in the areas of science, engineering, security, administration, and construction. If you have both a technical and confessional mind, Los Alamos may be the place for you. I invite you to explore the possibilities on the websites for the Town, Laboratory, and Redeemer Lutheran Church.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues, Etc. congregational sponsor. Beautiful Savior Lutheran, Spokane, Washington. Elm Grove Lutheran, Elm Grove, Wisconsin. Grace Lutheran, Elgin, Texas. Emmanuel Lutheran, Everett, Washington. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Brookings, South Dakota. Parkland Evangelical Lutheran, Tacoma, Washington. Redeemer Lutheran, Scottsdale, Arizona. St. John Lutheran, Rosemount, Minnesota. St. Paul Lutheran, New Haven, Indiana. And Trinity Lutheran, Springfield, Illinois. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues, Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, Etc. journal. Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. That's what you'll find at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Speakers include Mark and Molly Hemingway, Brian Wolfmiller, Robert George, Larry Rast, and Will Wheaton. We've already surpassed the current 100 in-person attendance limit, and if that in-person attendance limit is increased, early registrants will get top priority. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or by giving us a call, 618-223-8385. The 2021 Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. We're discussing COVID-19, the pandemic, and COVID vaccines with virology expert and LCMS layman, Dr. Nicholas Wogelmuth. Dr. Wogelmuth, Debbie in Moses Lake, Washington says, what needs to happen for these approved for emergency use vaccines to become approved for all-time use like other vaccines are, and what is the difference here?
The biggest hurdle for the vaccine approval process the normal way is time. You basically start off with really small studies and then get bigger and bigger and try the vaccine in lots of different populations. And then you can roll it out and say everyone from the age of 2 to 100 can get this vaccine. We didn't have that luxury this time. The reason it was able to go so fast is because of some of these, the platforms we used, and then the very creative ways they designed the studies to do safety and efficacy in as few studies as possible. To do that, they focused on mostly healthy adults. And so the emergency use authorization did not include children getting vaccinated, but those tests are ongoing and they are looking good. The biggest hurdle is time. And right now, a lot of people are getting vaccinated, and that's just adding more and more data to, and which is supporting the fact that the vaccines are working. So I'm guessing that whether it's 6 months from now or a year from now or 10 years from now, the FDA is going to say, yep, this is now an officially licensed vaccine. That's just a process that takes more time than this emergency use authorization.
Mark asks if there's some kind of virus competition effect to explain why the 2021 flu season barely occurred.
When people have looked at co-infections, there doesn't seem to be, you know, one virus winning out over the other. The best explanation, as far as I understand it, for the decrease in influenza virus over the past year is that the masks and social distancing that were put into place for COVID-19 also were very effective at stopping the spread of influenza. And I'm guessing if we looked at other respiratory viruses over that time, we would see the same thing. My hope is that after all this, everyone keeps some of their masks around so that whenever they get a cough or cold 5 years from now, 10 years from now, they know, well, if I wear this mask while I have my cold, I'll be less likely to get my family sick. Or if I go shopping at the grocery store, I'll be less likely to infect people there. And so I think what we've learned from this is that these masks and social distancing can be useful against more than just COVID-19.
I've heard several people wonder out loud in that vein whether or not flu season will be replaced from now on with COVID season.
That's a good question. I think that once things get back to whatever the new normal looks like after all this, flu will probably take over the primary respiratory pathogen of concern over time as we all get vaccinated against COVID-19. And so maybe for the next couple years, it might be supplanted. But unfortunately, I would expect that as we, you know, control COVID-19, people will probably let down their guard some, and that will allow influenza to come back and do its damage.
Megan asks, would you recommend women of childbearing years to get the COVID shot? I'm concerned about the unknowns of long-term effects for the vaccine and its potential effects on future fertility. A year of testing doesn't seem like enough time to give conclusive results on the potential side effects that happen years or decades down the road.
I've kind of talked about some of the risks for certain side effects, and there's no evidence so far that COVID-19 vaccines could lead to any problems with fertility. That being said, you know, it hasn't been that long since we've given these people these shots. But as a biologist, I cannot think of any plausible reason why a respiratory virus or a vaccine against a respiratory virus would lead to fertility issues. That's not something we've seen before, and I can't, through all my training about the mechanisms of disease and pathogenesis, I can't wrap my brain around quite how that would work. Again, we can't rule it out, but I think it's very, very, very unlikely.
Gail says, confirmation would be comforting in the form of a second opinion. Should a person wait 2 weeks after getting a different, in this case, pneumonia vaccine, then get the COVID-19 shot? Somewhere I read that a much longer time waiting between the two is recommended.
There unfortunately isn't a consensus answer for this. The CDC recommendation is to not get another shot 14 days on either side of the COVID vaccine. So if you just got the Pneumovax vaccine, then you may want to wait 14 days to get the COVID shot. And then if you get the COVID shot, you'll want to wait potentially a couple weeks to get vaccinated with something else. And that's not because we think that there will be a problem. It's just that it wasn't tested in conjunction with other vaccines. And so just to be on the safe side. And so I actually think a lot of physicians and medical providers are subscribing to the ethos that, you know, you never want to miss a chance to vaccinate. And so getting shots into arms as soon as possible is a good thing, even if, you know, it's only been 12 days since someone got vaccinated for Pneumovax. And so I think getting shots in people's arms will be what helps us in this pandemic. And so it's good that we're being careful, but I think just listen to the advice of your medical doctor or whoever's giving you the vaccine. Let them know whether you've had a vaccine recently and see what they recommend.
Melody in Virginia says, I'd like to know what the doctor thinks about singing and spreading of the virus. Is it really as deadly as some have publicized, or has there been an overreaction and it's not necessarily a super spreading event when you sing in a choir or congregationally? I have greatly looked forward to hearing your response.
So this comes from some studies in the past where people have looked at respiratory droplets released through various activities. We know that talking can release respiratory droplets. We know that coughing and sneezing can release a lot of respiratory droplets. But surprisingly, singing and laughing both are very good at causing you to release respiratory droplets, which then could contain the virus. And so there is a concern there. That being said, by following social distancing, which, you know, can probably be pretty hard in a choir, you can try to get around some of that. And so I think it's better safe than sorry. While singing, I don't think is going to often lead to super spreading events, it definitely is a higher risk activity than just having a conversation with someone. And so I think it's up to the individual or potentially, you know, the congregation or the church to decide whether they want to bring back the choirs or how they want to bring them back. But there is going to be at least a little bit enhanced risk when you have singing involved. But I don't think it should indefinitely shut down our choirs or anything like that.
With the caveat, of course, that no one can predict the future, near term or long term, you've watched events unfold over the last year. Do you think that as of today, there is light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak?
Yeah, I imagine that once most people get the vaccine, combined with the individuals that have already contracted the virus, we'll be getting close to what is known as herd immunity. And one thing, which means, you know, that the virus will be, the transmission will be greatly reduced to the point where we can start lifting some of the precautions. One thing that gives me hope that we're on that path is there's actually several different human coronaviruses that are in the same family as the novel coronavirus, the SARS coronavirus 2. And my guess is that when those viruses emerged in humans, whether it was 1,000 years ago or whatever, they caused a lot of disease and potentially killed a lot of vulnerable individuals that did not have good immunity to it. But as people got infected and then maybe even reinfected with lesser disease, enough people developed enough immunity that we're you know, no one gets too worried about the common cold. And so I hope that this virus ends up becoming just that. And I hope that the vaccine can do that quicker, speed that process along. And so yes, I think there's light at the end of the tunnel. And I think if we all work together and continue doing some of the things that we know can stop the transmission of the virus while people get vaccinated, I think we'll get there even sooner.
Dr. Nicholas Wolgebuth is Doctoral Research Associate, Infectious Diseases at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. Dr. Wolgebuth, thank you very much for your time.
Yep, thank you. I just want to state here that everything that I said today was based off of my own opinions and views, based off the facts as I understand them, and do not represent the opinions or views of my employer. Also, I just want to caveat that, you know, science is an always evolving process. We learn more and more about SARS coronavirus 2 and COVID-19 every day. So while I've given you the best information I have available today, we may learn that something I said might be false. And that's not because I was lying to you. It's because, you know, we just learned more and we didn't know yesterday what we know today. And we don't know today what we'll know tomorrow.
When we come back, we'll go through listener email, talkback@issuesetc.org, and the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we continue our walk through Hosea with Yahweh accuses Israel, consequences for apostasy, folly of idolatry, impending punishment, and meet the lion. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand. Listen at thewordendures.org or on your favorite podcast provider.
Superstition is the belief that one event caused an unrelated event. It's often tied up with false beliefs about God and how He works in the world. Is there really such a problem with superstitions? Is there really such a problem with saying, knock on wood or good luck? Explore this and more in the March issue of The Lutheran Witness. We will talk about scientism, superstition, New Age, and so much more. To order your copy, visit cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
St. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 2 that the Gentiles are without God in the world and without hope.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller talking about his presentation at the 2021 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Now that's an amazing statement. It means that to be without God is to be without hope, and the corollary, to be with God is to have hope. Christians are marked by this. We have hope. And we have hope not only in this life, but we have hope in the life to come. Our Christian hope expands past death, past the last day, even to the resurrection of the body, the new heaven and the new earth where the righteous dwell. We have this extended horizon of hope, and we dwell under that cloud of glory.
You can meet and hear Pastor Wolfmiller making the case for Christian hope at this year's Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 23rd and Saturday, July 24th at Concordia University, Chicago. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org.